Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This episode of Pardes Live and Miniseries features Rav Mike Foyer. For more information on how to download more podcasts, visit elmod.pardes.org.
Okay, so this is our final class together in this series. I'll mention at the end, if someone reminds me, it would be really helpful, what the upcoming class is for those of you guys who don't know. But for now, what I want to do is take a brief moment, and since not only not everybody was here for the first three classes, but also even those that were, it's been a two-week break. And not only a two-week break, but we've shifted. I mean, we've gone through Rosh Hashanah, and now we're here in really the final hours of the Aseret Yemei Teshuvah. So I think it's worth it to just touch back on a couple things. I'm not going to do a full review. It's not possible to sort of like encapsulate all of chapter 5 and still move forward today. But I do want to touch back on this chart, which presents us with two very different models of tshuva where we actually began, right? On stage left, that's stage left, right? Is like what I would call the classic model of tshuva as repentance, or even as return, meaning there's a sense that we talked about that tshuva begins with sin, right? Which is a strange assertion, but it is inevitably so, because if it were not for sin, there would be no tshuva, which begs the question that we're going to address today, right? Is sin a lechatchila? Is sin an a priori element of creation? Or is sin a mistake, and therefore it should never have come to be, and then tshuva is an expression of something fundamentally different? But no matter how you slice it, if you want to start the process of tshuva, it begins with failure, sin, deviation from self, right? We had that discussion of Rav Cook in particular was into this natural experience of pain and suffering that comes from wrongdoing, right? If you remember, that was the physical tshuva, where we had that model of illness that people know when they've done wrong, or people know when they've sort of violated their sense of self-integrity, even if it's not doing wrong to other, right? And so that's the symptoms, so to speak. And then we have this sort of turning point of regret, right? Regret, remember, the word for regret in Hebrew being what? Nachem, right? Nacham, nichamti, right? And we spoke a little bit about the fact that nachem also means what other term in English? Comfort, right? Nachamu, nachamu, ami. It's a very strange juxtaposition that you have one word that means both comfort and regret until you recognize it actually means neither. What it means is to change one's perspective after the fact, which makes sense, right? Regret something, like, I thought it was a good idea until I did it, and now I really regret that. And to find comfort in something, in a loss in particular, right, nichum avelim, right, is a decision to keep living after an event that you would have preferred not happen. On some level, you have to change your perspective, right? The going from being a mourner, where you're actually holding the pain of loss, which is a very, in my humble opinion, important and healthy part of mourning, there comes a part of which you're going to say, okay, I'm not going to dwell in the pain of loss forever. I must find some new way to relate to the fact that I no longer have this person I love. And that's what nechama is. It's a changing of perspective after the fact, right? So that's a very important turning point, one that we'll see has a parallel in this other model, right? There is, by the way, it's unfortunately often not put into the process of tshuva, but there also is a necessary belief in self that I can change, right? Which is not emphasized enough. And like when you look at the Rambam steps in tshuva, the Rambam never says you have to believe in yourself, because that's not the language the Rambam used. But the Rambam absolutely would agree with that, because he believed in you because God believes in you. Right? That's why the Rambam says that free will, of course, is one of the necessary underpinnings of Torah, that God wouldn't give you commandments if God didn't believe you were capable of choosing right from wrong. But nevertheless, then we have this act of tshuva, of return, and then the problematic there, as we've all, you know, I can't speak for you, I'll just speak for me, come this Yom Kippur, tomorrow night, going to be sitting there with my machzor, and when I open it up, there'll be that petek that I put in there every year, which has the exact same things on it. As I mentioned to you, I've added things, I don't know that I've ever actually removed anything. And so there is this strange sense that we'll speak about a little bit more, that there's something more than simply repeated failure going on here. Nevertheless, you're familiar with this. The model I offer to you, which Rav Cook certainly believes, so to speak, in that model, it's a classic model, an important one in understanding sort of the process of of sin and repentance. But there's another element in Rav Kook's thought that I offered you guys as the evolutionary element of tshuva. Came up at the end of our conversation last class, if you recall, which is you begin with proto-self, which is very similar to sin because it means that you're not actually who you want to be. You're in your raw state. You're fumbling around in the dark, emotionally, behaviorally, intellectually, whatever it is, right? And there's a struggle, pain and suffering, that goes with that because you have some sense that you're not who you believe you could be or believe you should be, however you want to define it. I wrote coming to consciousness instead of regret here because it's slightly different. Because this doesn't necessarily imply that you've done any active mistake. It's just a sense that I am not yet what I desire to be. And that coming to consciousness, either that I've done wrong, is based not on an external moral standard of what I should be doing, but is rather based on some estimation of who I really am. So it's known as the Musar de Gadlus, if you're familiar with this idea, that Musar is often associated in the school of Nevordak and others with this sense of you have done wrong. Not only you have done wrong, but you are a sinner. Like all the stories you hear about how in Nevordak they would go and like sleep in a coffin and they would make guys go into a hardware store and order, you know, bagels or whatever it is just to try to crush the ego, which, I mean, has its place. I'm personally not so into it. I mean, I like crushing other people's egos, and it's not my own. But there is another path in Musar, which is essentially you're too good to be acting that way. If you really appreciated how amazing you are, the tremendous potential you have, the power of your neshama, you wouldn't do these things. It's a fundamentally different approach. It's known as the Musar de Gadlut. You can say it's associated with maybe with the Sabbath Slobodka or others, but it's an important different perspective. So there's a coming to consciousness of what I could be. And then the tshuva becomes not a return to where you were, but an embodiment of what I would call here the second self. Right? There's a step forward. I'm going to ask more of myself because I know I'm capable of more than I'm doing. I can tell you as an educator that there is no more powerful tool in education than high expectations. Sometimes unreasonably high expectations. I was an outdoor educator for, a decade or so, both in the private world and also working with at-risk youth in a wilderness therapy. I think I mentioned it to you guys. And the watchword of outdoor education, particularly when you're working with at-risk youth, is I believe you're capable of more than you believe you are. Now, you never say it to anyone because that's demeaning, but you hold this inner belief. And I tell you, I've seen kids do things. I've watched, I'm thinking in particular of one young, very large young man who was from an urban environment, had probably never walked further than from his house to the bus stop in his whole life, carrying a quite heavy backpack up a pass in North Carolina, and every step of the way saying, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't. And me behind him very slowly going, yes, you can, yes, you can. And you know what happened? He absolutely did. He got to the top, and as he's getting to the top, you know what he's saying? I can't do this. And I said, turn around. And he looked, and it was transformative. Because he realized, on some level, that he was living inside a story about himself of what he couldn't do, which was simply false. Because, sadly, I happen to know the kid quite well, he'd been raised in a world of very low expectations. You know, and so therefore, holding that space for other people is a very powerful tool. And here, also holding it for one's self. You know, I'm going to say it now, lest I forget later. Everyone tonight should go home and write down on a piece of paper two very simple sentences. One says, this is what I am, period. And you write next to it, and I will be, ... And I want you to put it in your machzor before you go to shul. And when you do your vidui, pull it out. Because it's often forgotten that the two have to come together. A vidui is about looking oneself in their face. If you don't actually look at who you are and what you've done, you can't, you know what? If you close your eyes to the situation you don't want to see, you know what you do? You end up stuck in exactly what you don't want because it's the last thing you've ever seen. Right? Whereas if you look at what you are, you can open yourself to the next question, which is, and I will be. And it's an open-ended You don't have to answer that. Sometimes it's just enough to raise the question. Yeah, you want to say something? Ellen? What? I wouldn't fill it in. I think you should contemplate it while you're doing your vidui, because I think too often the vidui is just about what I am and doesn't give enough space to what I will be.
An example applied to a patient is an educator named Leo Buscaglia. Uh-huh. He talks about this thing called a Harvard Spirit Test. What they did is they went to inner city schools and they would tell the teacher that this student is going to progress this year. And often it was somebody who was, you know, not doing very well.
Right.
He said, I can't believe it, but then Harvard says it.
Right.
And inevitably these kids did better than...
I'm telling you, I have seen it time and again. It's an astounding truth, which raises a lot of questions about what we're doing to the kids that aren't succeeding. but that's, I don't want to go too far into my educational rant. But for our purposes, it means that there's an evolutionary potential in tshuva if it combines both that sentence of this is what I am and I will be, and then it's a question. It's a question which, yeah, I would encourage you to answer it while you're there in shul, right? But I wouldn't write it down beforehand because I think that the, you know, evolution is an open-ended process, as we're going to see. So I wanted to put those back on the board. Whatever, we don't get to that. We, you know, basically, I'm just talking to myself right now. The other piece, which didn't come out directly, but it came out sort of obliquely, at least in my notes, I don't recall, actually, we spoke about it in class, is the problematic relationship between will and behavior. Oh, we did. We did the Ben and Jerry's thing, for sure it came up, right? This problematic relationship between will and behavior, that meaning I can say that I want something, and yet I'll find myself often doing the opposite, right? I want to lose weight and eat healthy, and yet at 10 at night I'm, you know, finishing off the fish food Ben and Jerry's, standing by the freezer while no one's looking, right? Now, on one level, that's just simply what is often called sort of higher will, lower will, right? But on another level, it's very important to recognize that most often, I don't think always, because I'm wary of the absolutism there, but I think most often, our failures are expressive of real needs and desires. Our failures are expressive of real needs and desires. There's just a maladaptive behavior that we've somehow learned of how to meet that need. So, like, when I'm there at the fridge macking down the Ben and Jerry's, it might be that what I really need is some sense of acknowledgement of a job well done, or simply the appreciation of the hard work, or maybe just some emotional comfort, or whatever it actually, there's a real need there. And it's probably not the best way to attain that, right, to be, you know, putting down the high-calorie ice cream. Which, by the way, I'm not saying it's intrinsically bad. If anybody likes to do this, don't feel I just have a judgment on myself that this is not what I need to be doing. Right. Right. Because there's a training. We feel the need. The need is real, but we've trained a maladaptive behavior to meet the need. And what often happens is the need doesn't go away. In fact, it gets stronger. But then we continue to pursue the same behavior, because that's the way we've learned to meet the need, and it's insufficient, or sometimes actually a complete mismapping. In that respect, there's a very important element that's going to come up in our learning today, which is the seeking after essential will. What the Kabbalah calls re'uta deliba, right? This sort of the one's heart's desire. And there's another practice I encourage you guys. It's a good one for this time of year as well. It's better done with a pen and paper and, frankly, with a chavruta. But you state a want, right? What's something that somebody wants? It doesn't have to be overly dramatic, but not like too simple. Something you want. I'm not going to put you on the spot.
Lose weight.
Right? And then you pursue that, right? And I want that because. You finish the sentence. You don't have to right now. I'm going to put you on the spot. But you're going to come up with something. I want that because... I want to feel good about myself, right? And I want that because, I want to feel good about myself because, right? That, you know, then people will look at me and smile. And I want people to look at me and smile because it makes me feel loved. Oh, and I want to feel loved because, you understand? What you're doing there is you're stripping away the specific manifestations and getting at what's the core will which is expressed. Which, by the way, doesn't mean that the behavior is wrong. Don't misunderstand me. Oftentimes, the behavior is actually a well-adapted expression in behavior of the will, but not always. And what stripping down between manifest behavior and essential will, getting at the re'uta deliba does, is it frees you to then choose other ways to manifest that will. If what I realize is that I want love and I'm turning to Ben and Jerry's to get it, which may sound silly, but is actually, I think, quite familiar to many people out there, right? Then if I have a judgment that perhaps there's a high cost to me in health by getting my love by eating Ben and Jerry's, then I'm free now. Now, it's not so easy, it's a deep tshuva, but at least have the opportunity to try to manifest that need in another and healthier way. You understand the process? It's a very important process that is essential to Rav Kook's perspective on tshuva, which is about expressing essential self. Those are the two pieces I wanted to sort of revisit, even though that last one in particular we didn't express, you know, explicitly. And now, questions or comments, and then we're going to dive back into the text, because there's actually quite a bit I'd like to do in this last class. Yeah, Joe?
About expectations.
Don't have any. No, I'm kidding.
Okay, setting expectations high for yourself.
Uh-huh. To grow, and yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know, my mother always used to say the key to happiness in life is low expectations, right? So this brings us back to another very important piece we spoke about, which is how we define rachamim, right? The Yom Kippur is also known in many ways as the Yom HaRachamim, Rachamim Gedolim, right? It comes up in our liturgy all the time. How we define Rachamim fundamentally changes whether expectations inevitably lead to disappointment or whether they are a powerful driver for growth. But what do I mean? Will you guys do me a favor and just close those doors? Because I don't know about you, I'm distracted by the background noise. Thank you, Vipa. The difference in the definitions, I would say, goes like this. When I, in counseling in particular, when I tell someone that they have to have more rachmanut on themselves, most of the time what people hear me saying is you need to let yourself off the hook. Right? And then they react quite strongly, particularly men, act very strongly, like, no, because then I'll just drink beer and sit on the couch and watch football all day. Right? If I really let myself off the hook, it's very interesting that the definition of mercy, of rachmanut that many people have is, truth is, you either succeed or you're a failure. And the way you succeed is by never having any mercy on yourself. Does this sound familiar to anyone? Right? The inner whip hand is a very big part of motivation for most people's psychology. But the truth is, that's not what the word means. It's actually not what the word means. Right? If you look, what is the great moment of rachamim in the Hebrew Bible, when the Yud Gimel Midot Rachamim, the 13 attributes of mercy, are revealed to Moshe? We've been saying these words out loud. I mean, did it how many times this morning? It's like quite seasonal. Where's the moment? Well, but what the moment actually, that's the result. You're correct. So let's go through it very, very briefly. Moshe goes up on the mountain. God himself, whatever your theology is, just go with the narrative. God himself says, here, this is exactly what I want for you. Written down in 10 easy statements. Moshe brings it down the mountain. What are the people doing? Violating number one and number two. Right? They're dancing around the golden calf. Moshe thinks, disaster. I mean, disaster. It's a complete disaster. Breaks the luchot, grinds up the calf, kills 3,000 people. And then he says, okay, you guys stay here. I'm going to go back and see if I can somehow fix this. I can fix this. I can at least get us back to where we were. He gets up there, right? That's what day, by the way, that he breaks Luchot? Yud Zayin B'Tammuz. It takes him a day to sort of clean house in the camp. He goes back up for 40 days, right? Which means he on the 28th of Av, right? He has there's an intermediate day that for whatever reason, the Seder Olam Rabbah has to count, right? On the 28th of Av, he manages to get things back to where they were. And then there's 40 more days where he now goes up again, both physically back up the mountain, but also spiritually, there's a whole new moment. Because when God says, Slachti kidvarecha, which actually he says by the spies, but whatever, we lump them together, right? That when God says, I've forgiven them, what's Moshe's response? Is it, whew, got out of that one? What does he say? Show me your glory. Hareini na kvodecha. What on earth is Moshe doing? He jumps for it, and God says, whoa, Adam le'yani b'chai, like, you know, you won't even be human if you go that far. It's like, what, have you ever wondered, like, what's happening there? And then, but God says, but I'll give you these 13 attributes of mercy. That's where they come out from. Why? Because what does Moshe realize is that this was not an act of failure, which, thank God, he was able to schlep us back to where we were, because nebuch, human beings, what are you going to do? God will have mercy on us. He'll let us off the hook. No. It was a breakdown that led to a depth of engagement which produced a profundity of relationship which did not exist before. Absolutely. Well, Moshe's human too. I don't know. God would have accepted it. I don't think Moshe was capable of doing it. God was there, because what happens at the end is that at the end, there's not just another chance. When Moshe brings the Luchot down from the mountain, it's the same Luchot, yes? Except they're indifferent in one very important way, is now the people want them. What day does he bring it down on Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur is expressive of tshuva as coming to want for myself what God wanted for me all along. What's the difference? Is if God wants it for me and I don't want it, then it's not who I am. And therefore, at best, I'll fall away and schlep back and God's mercy will allow me to, like, get off the hook. But if I can come to want for myself what God wants for me, then mercy is, as the language implies, rachamim is the lashon of rechem, of a womb, that God has held space for me to grow into that which God knew I could always be. That's why God offered the luchot in the beginning. He knew we were capable of it, just not yet. And mercy is not a letting myself off the hook. It's the accepting the fact that to achieve anything, I'm going to fail. So yeah, high expectations and a recognition that I'm not there yet. Right? Mercy is a code word. Process, everybody, you're all into process. People, I mean process. You know what process is? A code word for failure. It is, because if I weren't in process, then I'd already be there. And if I'm not there yet, but I have a judgment that that's where I ought to be, that means I'm failing. No, I'm not failing, I'm in process. Right, like I said. Right? You understand? I mean, obviously a very important difference. It doesn't have the judgment. It's a recognition of the nature of human existence, which is evolutionary. Right, and so the reason that Yom Kippur is seen as this great day of rachamim is that it's the day in which we come to want for ourselves what God wanted for us all along, because that's what really matters. Just think about it as a parent. We've had this discussion, I'm sure, before. It's like, as a parent, my goal is not that my children will obey me and always do what's right. My goal is that my children will be the type of people who do what's right because it's right, not because they hear my voice in their head going, no, no. Right? You want to produce human beings, not robots. That's the same with God. So, that answer your question? Okay. So, meanwhile, back in the text. So where are we right now? We're at the end of the fifth chapter. In the handout you have here, we're either in the English, it's the bottom of page one. In the Hebrew, it's... Actually, the bottom, page two. Tshuva Kadmat Lo'olam. Other questions or comments before we get rolling into this? We'll do what we can. I'll try to wrap it up in a nice, neat package, which is impossible. But questions, comments, things people want to clarify? All right, don't be shy. Okay. So Rav Kook says here, I'm in either Vav Aleph or 6A, depending on how you look at it. Tshuva kadmil olam. He's quoting the Gemara and also a couple of statements in the Midrash, which is a funny notion. Right away, let's just get it straight. If tshuva kadmil olam, if tshuva precedes creation, precedes the world, then which model are we in here on the board perforce? We've got to be over here, because if tshuva is simply God letting us off the hook for sin, and sin never should have happened, then tshuva can't have preceded the world. Tshuva was like an ad hoc measure that God puts in. Adam never should have eaten from the tree, but since he did, God didn't want to waste all that energy he put into creation, so to speak, so like, okay. It doesn't work. It just simply doesn't work, by the way. It doesn't fit the story, not in its shot, and certainly not in its moral implications. Nevertheless, largely, I think, because of Christian influence in the way people read it, that is the way Jews tend to relate to the story. Adam never should. He blew it. Really? It ever strike you as a setup? Here, you can have all these trees. Eat them all. Not that one. See that one right there? Eat them all, but not that one. Which one? That one. And then the snake shows up, who seems to know everything that happened up till now. It's a strange story. Anyway, you can come upstairs later, and we're going to discuss it for the rest of the semester. So Tshuva Kadmil Olam is not Rav Kook's Hiddush, but as is his style, he does his own thing with it. And therefore, not only does it precede the world, it is the foundation of the world. Notice, the foundation is, of course, what you build on. Meaning, without tshuva, the world as we know it does not exist, because this is not a world of perfection. It is not a static world, as he's told us. It's an evolutionary world. And to have an evolutionary world, you don't just have to have high expectations. You have to have the ability to fail and pick yourself up. You have to have real rachamim. So therefore, it is the foundation of the world, which we know, shlemutam shel chayim hidavkim hemshech hitgalutam al pi tivam ha'atzmi. He says the wholeness of life is specifically through the sort of continual revelation according to their own independent nature. There's all this stuff in your DNA, and you don't really know what it is until what happens? It becomes manifest. There's all this stuff in your character. It's really funny to take an 18-year-old suburbanite kid who basically has always had everything that they've ever needed, and comfort, of course, in Western culture is a religion, and to teach them how to wipe their tush with rocks and leaves. I've done it many times. I can't remember a very funny incident where our campers came to us, they were students, but whatever, and said to me and my co-counselor, you guys have the toilet paper? And I looked at Andy. Andy, did you bring the toilet paper? He's like, what? I didn't bring the toilet paper. Did you bring the toilet paper? I didn't. And we started looking around. We're like, what are we going to do? Oh, look. River stones. You know? Because of the ethic of the outdoor program, which I led, was what's called a zero-impact ethic. We didn't use toilet paper at all. But what's my point is you never really know who you are until you're faced with situations that you've never faced before. And this is what Cook's saying, is that there's a continual revelation of the perfection of life, which happens on its own natural course, right? But what he says, but v'kevan she'hateva b'tzal atzmo eina ba'al histaklut v'havchana. You can't just look at something's nature, right? And anybody who tries to do that is usually, at best, an ignoramus, at worst, a bigot. I know this kid. I know those type of people. It's in their nature. Ever heard that one before? Right? So you say you can't actually look at the nature of a thing. And since that is so, you actually need sin. Why? Because if you don't fail and muck around, you'll never actually know what you're capable of and what you really are. And then he says, and you know, Rav Kook is famous. Oh, the simple reading of that verse is, there is no righteous way. There is no righteous man on earth who does good and sins not. The simple reading of that is everybody sins, right? But I think, you know, Rav Kook, one of my teachers once told me, is that every time Rav Kook uses a pasuk, you have to assume he's completely revolutionizing its standard meaning. I mean, it's not always true, but you have to assume it first. And here I think it's very clear what he's saying. You can't be a tzaddik without sinning. Instead of saying there's no such thing as a perfect person, which I think he would agree with that statement, he's going further. He just said, oh, you want to be a tzaddik? Then you have to sin. Why? Because what's a tzaddik in Rav Kook's language? Someone who is perfectly expressive of their teva atzmi, of their independent essential nature. How you get at your independent essential nature cannot be a sort of an external process of looking and seeing what it is, because you can't see the nature of a thing. It has to find its expression through process. This should sound familiar. That's why I set things up this way. I read ahead, I admit it, right? Bitul etzem tiviotam shel achayim. If you sort of nullify the very nature of life, in order kidei sheyeh adam bilti chote, in order that a person should just never sin, listen to this. Ze'atzmo acheta yoter gadol. That would actually itself be the greatest sin. What on earth did he just say? He just said, do the logic. The tshuva kadma l'olam. Right? It's not an accident. It's not an ad hoc sort of policy put in place because humanity couldn't handle existence. It is the essential foundation of what life is. Which means, says Rav Kook, right, life is evolutionary. And it continues to reveal itself through the process of its natural expression. But you cannot a priori define the nature of a thing. Therefore, how do you figure it out? The way we all figure it out. You muck along. And some things work and some things don't. At a certain point, hopefully, you reach an age or a stage of wisdom where you say, you know what, this is who I am. And hopefully you don't stop there. But, you know, it's also you don't reinvent the wheel every day. It's a dynamic. Right? And that's why hopefully a person gets happier as they get older. Because they get over that angst that so many people face of, like, not knowing who they are and having to be somebody else. And then they say, just being comfortable with, you know, the truth is, this is who I am. Which doesn't mean you're static and settled, but it also means at a certain point you've gone through enough in life to discover, yeah. Truth is, if you had asked me that when I was 20, I would never have thought who I was. But now that I'm 60, and I've gone through enough of my life, I can see, yeah, this is who I am. Right?
So in that narrative, that even Moshe
Rabbeinu
was a sinner.
It's explicit in the Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu was a sinner. It says God doesn't let him go into the land because he struck the rock and the whole thing. Yeah.
Well, forget the rock. I'm talking about the Lukot.
Yeah, the Lukot is funny. It's true. I think the easiest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Luchot is funny, I say, for two reasons. First of all, I agree with you what you're saying. It's in a simple reading, it's symptomatic of the same behavior that got him in trouble explicitly. He got angry and he broke something, you know? At the same time, there's a beautiful Rashi, the last Rashi on the entire Chumash. Is what, right? The, you know, all the Otot, all the great things of Moshe Asa, right? Asher Asa. Be'nei kol Yisrael, which Moshe did in the eyes of all of Israel. So Rashi says, Asher Asah, what did Moshe do that all of Am Yisrael saw? And we could think of a lot of things, right? Splitting the Red Sea, I don't know, bringing down the man. So Rashi says, no. No, breaking the Luchot. That was the great act of Moshe, was breaking the Luchot. What, first of all, the fact that Rashi sees fit to end his commentary on the Torah with the breaking of the Torah deserves reflection, but he's going at something deeper, which is that even in Moshe's anger, there was a sense of rectitude and what was necessary. Because what would have happened if Moshe had said, "Stop that calf! I've brought something from God." What's the most likely thing that people would have done? If they did, though, they would have taken the calf out of the middle and put the luchot right in its place. Because the problem wasn't the calf, and the problem wasn't the luchot. The problem was the people. Right, and so his anger was not necessarily misdirected there. I mean, I think you're correct in your reading. I'm just pointing out the reason that the rabbis in particular, they're not so into apologetics when it comes to, I mean, Rashi is, but the rabbis themselves. But that act is seen as a very important moment for Moshe. And he plays it out in his commitment going back to God and defending Israel. But I think you're correct. He lost his cool. I imagine so. Wipe me from your book. He says, right? He says, wipe me from your book. I don't know about you guys, but when I say that kind of thing, it means like I'm a failure and I don't want to be any part of this anymore. Yeah, I hear it. I think you're correct. Yeah. Okay. So then Rav Kook says that basically a desire to take away the capacity to sin would actually be the greatest sin itself. Because then there would be no growth. And since the human being is an evolutionary project, right? And this is, I think, in this sense, he's wary of the idealization that comes, both in Christianity, where Cook is often fighting Christianity, sometimes subtly, sometimes less so, in this sense that humanity is a fallen being, and that the ideal is to live, at least in this world, in sort of the monastic removed environment where one never sins. But he's saying, no. The ideal is tshuva. You understand? That's why I started where I started. The ideal, tshuva, is not an ad hoc solution to a problem which should have never been, in the same way that mercy is not a compromise with the failed state of humanity. Tshuva is the foundation of the world, and mercy is a lechatchila. It's an a priori approach to existence because it is what allows us to grow and evolve. Right? And so therefore, sin, as he says explicitly now, it wasn't just me, right, is actually, right, he says, right, Kedeshi Adam, well, I want to get this right, it had to be. Sin is an absolute necessity from this perspective, which is not what you expect to hear from a rabbi, right? And then he gives this pasuk, which I've struggled in how he's reading it, so I don't want to garble it, but it's, in his eyes, another rereading of that pasuk would demonstrate his point, but I'm not going to pretend that I understand how he's reading it. He says, Alkein ha-tshuva mitakenet et ha-kilkul. That's, and so therefore, tshuva fixes that which is broken or corrupt. And it fixes that which is broken and returns life to its source. Notice, Dava Begilu Yesod Atzmiotam Ha'Elyon, specifically by revealing this sort of foundation of their higher essence. It's not about getting back to what was, in which case that fits the whole narrative of the world's just broken and Nebuch, and at least God let us off the hook. But it actually, tshuva gets you closer to that essential selfhood, which is always Rav Kook's definition of the human project, as he calls it, Olam HaCherut, right, the world of freedom, Va'al Shem Kach, Mahanim Shem Hashem Elohim Chaim. And since that is so, we call God the living God. God is not static. We're live here, people, right? You know, because you know what a static God is? An idol, right? If you think about it, this is a habit of mind and behavior we call objectification. Right? It gets a lot of attention these days in the relationship between the genders, the objectification of women. Right? It's probably the most familiar topic people out there. Right? What does it mean? So I take a woman, a picture of a woman that people find attractive, I put her up on a billboard in order to use what? A person's sexual desire to sell orange juice. You know, it's a strange thing, but we do it, right? And what have I done? That she's not a human being. She's an object which serves a particular purpose of the advertiser and taps into a particular side of the viewer, etc. But that's what we mean. We've taken a live human being and created an object. Well, when you do that with human beings, you freeze them. And by the way, it happens also in interpersonal relationships, right? I know you. I mean, I actually don't know you so well, Brian, but like I have this, I don't actually know you. I have a concept called Brian in my mind. Right? I have all kinds of associations with it and probably judgments, conscious, unconscious, etc. And if I'm honest, I try to make a separation between that and you. But it's not so easy. And especially as an educator, a parent, as a human being walking through the world, it's a lot easier to just decide that you can categorize people and know them. Right? It's the breakdown of most marriages. Right? That people form some concept of the person that they married somewhere early in their married life. And, you know, usually for the first 10 years or so, there's enough of a mapping between that concept and the actual person, or there's enough of a hesitation to actually be who I really am in the face of my spouse, that works. And then about around 10 years, may sound familiar to some people, like someone wakes up in the morning and looks, you're not the person I married. And they're like, you're darn straight, and I'm getting tired of you thinking that I am. Okay, it depends. It depends, you know. But that's objectification. I don't know you, because you as a subject, as a live, I have to wake up every morning and basically say, who are you? Which is scary, and disruptive, which is why most people don't do it. And if you have a healthy relationship, you make space for it. And, you know, there is something to be said for also, you know, I don't care who you are. Can you just do the things that need to get done right now? That's a realistic part of a relationship as well, you know. But when that's called objectification when we apply it to people. But when we apply it to God, it's called idolatry. Thinking that you can freeze God into some concept that you can grasp and therefore interact with is the ultimate idolatrous practice, which is why there's always a very thin line between religion and idolatry. That's what religion does, which is why Rav Kook is pushing against a lot of the classic religious models here. I mean, listen, this is what most, I mean, today it's not so popular to talk this way, but in the early 20th century, most of the religious world talked about tshuva this way. You have sinned, now repent. Rav Kook says, yeah, for sure. You can see it in his early writings. He's not unaware of it, but he's just pointing out it's a very limited tool for becoming a live human being. Elohim Chaim, live, living God, is served by free Israelites, right? This, as he says, this Olam HaCherut, which is one of the great sort of innovations of Rav Kook's thought, that he sees freedom as the essential component of the divine within the human being. Not necessarily get better, just okay. New expression.
All right, so just remind me something decades ago when they got this wrong, that, you know, the new Orthodox world, certainly the cultural Orthodox, but the general Orthodox world, is that the generations that were before were smarter, better, older,
sure.
Whatever, and you can't disagree with Nelson on Moshe,
yep.
The pecking order. Yep. Right?
Yeah, I mean, you see it in the Gemara. Well, listen, Yiriyat HaDorot, I don't know specifically in Rav Kook, but I think I can speak to the issue, which is Yiriyat HaDorot, the descent of generations.
Okay.
Right? That's this concept, right? This, it's rooted in the Gemara. It's both rooted in the Gemara in Agadic, meaning there's sort of like narrative statements around how if the previous generations were angels, then we're men. If they were donkeys, then we're, like, you know, then we're even lower. You know, the if they were men, then we're donkeys. So there's that. Then there's also structurally, like you're pointing out, once the Mishnah was sealed, so the Amoraim, nominally at least, don't argue on the Mishnah. You know, and then once... Yeah, well, I mean, like an interpret is even a kind word. I mean, they're fairly free in their reading. And the same way, once the Gemara is sealed, so, you know, but you see that the reality is more complex. But very important, and this I think speaks directly to Rav Kook, just remember that the further you get from Sinai is also the closer you get to the Messiah. Is also the closer you get to the Messiah. And Rav Kook's writings, we're not going to get to them here, but his writings are filled with this sense that there is a revolution, that the Torah of Mashiach makes the Torah of this world look like Hevel. That's a quote. Now, it's the same kind of quote that got him, Shabtai Tzvi, the Baal Shem Tov, and Jesus of Nazareth all lumped in the same category. You can't do that. Why? Because if you're wrong, what happens is the people fall apart. At the same time, this is one of the problems with thinking that the ultimate goal of all religious life is reproducing children who are just like me. Right? Orthodoxy, as a social phenomenon, rests upon the notion that my children will be just like me. Right? The problem with that is that the purpose of the Torah is to bring the presence of God to earth. And since I've never seen the presence of God on earth, if I think that I'm going to fulfill the purpose of the Torah, then I've got a problem between those two things. And this, if you're interested, I can't do it now, but Rav Kook's writings on what's called Le Mahalach Idiot B'Yisrael, the progress of ideas, in the sense Platonic ideals, within Israel, is one of his important takes on the evolution of the national and the religious or spiritual conceptions, which sees religion as a product of exile. Exile, which means that with redemption, what happens? And that he doesn't address directly there, but in many places he hints at this sense that there's a revolution coming. I would call it an evolution. I mean, he's never, even though we do get midrashic statements about the sort of, you know, the mitzvot disappearing in the time of the Mashiach, etc., you know, Kook is very, very wedded to the structure of halakha and the mitzvot, but he sees an evolutionary capacity and spiritual existence which we haven't even dreamed of. All right, that's a short answer to an important question. You know what I want to do right now? I want to shift gears because where we're sitting right now is best served by jumping to the final text I wanted to look at. The last two paragraphs here are beautiful, but I think that we've gotten the essential work out of chapter 5. So turn to page 5, where you'll find what I find to be one of the most moving pieces, one of the earliest pieces of Rav Kook I ever learned. I had the merit to learn it from my teacher, of Daniel Cohn, and really opened my eyes to a lot of the potential within Rav Kook's writings. It's from Ohel Kodesh, which is one of the works that was published after Rav Kook's life. It was edited by Rav David Cohen HaNazir. He was one of Rav Kook's chief students. He was indeed a Nazir. It wasn't just a nickname. The person can become a Nazir. Be careful what you vow, since there's no temple. Once a Nazir, always a Nazir. But you can do it, and he was. But that's Ohel Kodesh was a work that was published posthumously. And here, this piece is called Bakashat Hani Atzmi, the seeking of the essential I. And before we get into the text, and I do want to do it, I'm going to do it justice, please God. I just want to point out that I mentioned to you guys that Rav Kook is always operating on at least three scales. There's the individual, there's the national, and there's sort of like all of creation, although sometimes, like I pointed out to you, he sticks a fourth scale in there, humanity and creation, depending on what his point is. If people are familiar with what's called the fourfold song, you may be familiar with that structure. But in this case, it's important to recognize that exile functions on all three scales as well. The exile on the personal scale is what we call alienation from self. Right? Because remember, exile is premised on the notion that I belong elsewhere. Just think, it's on the personal scale, on the national historical scale, and they'll be on the creation scale. Personal scale, alienation from self. I do something, and I say, that's not who I am. Now, it's a two-step process. It's a recognition that I've done something, and it's also the assertion that that's not who I am, that I have some sense of essential self. Because sometimes I do something, and you know what I discover? That is who I am. You know, we call that growth, right? So not all change in action, it's not intrinsically a static approach to existence. I'm going to point that out. There's a difference between exile and growth, and it's a fine line. On the national historical scale, exile is kipshuto. You have a people that were in their land, we were in our land. Along comes another empire and knocks us out of our land. We're in exile. But why are we in exile? Because when we go away to Babel, you know what we take with us? The book of Jeremiah. The book of Jeremiah says you're going to come back in 70 years, build houses, plant vineyards, but no, you're coming back. And so therefore, we are in exile. Otherwise, it's just called history. Because, you know, the Turkish people don't see themselves as in exile from Central Asia, even though that's where the tribes that make up the modern Turkish people came from. Why don't they see themselves as in exile? Because they have no intention of going back, right? It's the assumption that I am elsewhere that creates exile. And by the by, for those of you who spend a little time with American Jewry in particular, you might have noticed that American Jewry is not in exile anymore. And that's one of the deep, deep problems in the conversation between Israeli Jewry and American Jewry, which is not being spoken about. Because bottom line, the average American Jew doesn't see themselves as other than where they belong. And so they've been creating for 70 plus years a model of Judaism which doesn't depend upon some sense that I ought to be elsewhere. And lo and behold, it doesn't get along so well with the people who built the model of Judaism which is built on there is nowhere else to be. In the Eretz Acheret, right? So it's not a surprise. That's the personal, the national, the existential scale we spoke about. If you remember, I think it was last time we met, we spoke about the great mythic presentation of the Arizal about creation. Right? How that in the beginning there was only God, and that the first act of creation is what? The first act of creation is withdrawal. We call it tzimtzum. It's the creation of an empty space, what the Rizal calls a halal panui, into which the divine light is then re-emanated. We spoke about the breaking of the vessels, etc. But it's important to note That's exile. God creates elsewhere and puts creation in it. And what does creation spend the rest of existence trying to do? Get back to source. Right? This is another meaning of the idea that tshuva kadma la'olam. If in the beginning there was only God and God created separation, as we've spoken about, because separation is always the necessary precursor to relationship, then all of creation is exile. Toward what end? In order to have relationship. Because as we pointed out, that the act of othering is either the basis of all hatred or the basis of all relationship. But you don't have a relationship unless there's an other. Right? So on these three scales, exile exists, which means that on the personal scale of alienation and sin, that means tshuva exists at them all as well. And this piece nominally is about the individual scale, but as you'll see, I think it's about much more. So you guys ready? It's a good piece. I think we can do it justice. If I start to speak too quickly, you'll forgive me. Okay, so he says, V'ani b'toch ha'gola. Right? It's a quote from the beginning of the book of Yechezkel, as you can see there, first line. But he's playing with the words. It literally means, I was in the midst of the exile. Right? Yechezkel, of course, historically, this is before the destruction of the first temple. He's taken away in the first exile, 11 years before the Babylonians destroyed the first temple. King Jehoiachin is taken away with the sort of nobles and prophets and wise men of Jerusalem are taken away before the temple. And so therefore they're in Babel when the temple is destroyed, which is much the dynamic of the book of Yechezkel, if you're familiar with it. But Rav Kook is playing with it. He's not just saying, I was in the mix of the exile. He goes on and says, Ani ha'pnimi ha'atzmi, the inner essential I of the individual and of the community, that's what we're speaking about here. Your I is in exile. You've lost your selfhood. It's so funny when I read this with my students because they assume that that's like a postmodern idea. And here's Rav Kook, right, writing this, we don't know exactly when, I don't know exactly when, but he died in 1935, so Minastam was before that, right? So it's a pretty radical move. He's pointing out that the inner essential I, be it of the individual and of the community, notice the scale. He's assuming there's an individual I of a community or a nation, right? Is only revealed in its essence according to the degree of its sanctity and purity, right? There's somehow, sanctity and purity are very loaded words in our culture. They're also words that deserve their full articulation. But considering what my goal is in learning this, let's just say it this way. Something which is holy is, how would you define that? Oy. That was a good answer, Abram. Oy. Not this one again. What? Separate. So separate is a very strong and very relevant word. It's a common definition, although I would argue that it is symptomatic and not essential, except when it's applied to God. What do I mean? If I had a cow in this room, aside from the tremendous mess that it was making, right, and I wanted to devote it to the temple, the verb in Hebrew is? What? No, it's actually not litrom. It's lahakdish. Lahakdish. To make it kodesh. Lahakdish, or try it this way. The Hebrew word, at least in rabbinic Hebrew, for marriage is kiddushin. Right? It's an act of sanctification. Well, it's an act of devotion. It's an act of devotion. I devote this cow to the Beit HaMikdash. People become devoted to each other. And they get married. Now, where did the separation go? Well, it's very obvious. Once the cow is hekdesh, a devoted property, it now has what we call isur mi'ilah. It's forbidden to be used for anything else. It becomes separate. That's what I meant when I said the separateness is correct, but it's symptomatic and not essential. It doesn't become holy by separating it from things. It becomes separate because you have devoted it to something. In the same way, two people who become married are separate from physical intimate relationships with other people. You don't become married by deciding you're separate from physical intimate relationships with other people. You understand? It's symptomatic, but it's not the essential. Right? So here, except when it comes to God, because God, of course, is other. That word, when we label God as kadosh, It's the inaccessible. Kadosh v'nora shemo. Right? And God, what we say there, but in a strange inversion, that God's holiness is shown through God's devotion to the world. Because if God weren't devoted to the world, where would the world be? It wouldn't. Right? Because God's otherness is actually violated by the existence of the world. That's a discussion we can have another time. If I just confuse you, you'll forgive me. But he says that you can only really reveal your essential I according to the degree of your sanctity. I mean, how devoted are you to that, and how separate from everything which distracts you, and the purity, we'll just leave that at its simplicity, right? Although, you know, what's the vehicle of purity in Jewish law? A mikvah. And what is the number one law of the mikvah? You go into that water and there can be nothing, what? Separating you, right? That there's an intimacy of contact. Purity is the gateway to holiness in Jewish tradition, right? And in order to get to purity, you must remove all barriers. So there's a devotion and a sort of an absolute intimacy with the selfhood, which are the only way to reveal it. And also according to the measure of its supernal might absorbed from the pure light of the higher illumination that flames within it. Whoa, classic Rav Kook language. Which I'm not going to unpack right now, but I would point out that this higher illumination Rav Kook is playing with a tension which runs throughout his work, which is, where does selfhood reside? Right? Is there only God and I'm one manifestation of God? Or am I actually a discrete unit, right, who then enters into relationship with God? In the same way, do citizens come together under a social contract to form a people, right? Like, sort of like the contractarian result of, you know, Enlightenment thought. Or does a people exist and each individual gains their individuality insofar as they're expressive of that collective will, consciousness, soul? You understand? Those are two different ways of looking. And here Rav Kook is just playing with attention. You find your individuality both through your sanctity and commitment, your devotion and your intimate attachment to it, and also through that absolute higher light, which your individuality is absorbing at all times. And then he goes into his poetic language. We sin with our fathers. In Hebrew, it's v'chatanu im avoteinu, which is like, you know, this time of year it sounds familiar. And now he's going to go through a series of sin, but their sin as alienation from self. And I want to get them straight, because in many ways they offer a very important model for how to access the process of tshuva, which of course is central to this time. That's why we're doing Rav Kook and tshuva. Tomorrow is the big day. You guys ready for game day? I'm ready for Sukkot. I have to admit it, that every year the first shofar of Elul, I have the same thought every year, which is, this is just what we have to get through to get to Sukkot. Right? I try to suppress it. It doesn't always work, but... Okay, so she says, Chatanu im avoteinu. Now, meaning, there's an intergenerational element of sin. And I want to tread lightly here, because there's another tradition which makes a quite big deal out of this. What am I speaking about? Christianity and the idea of original sin. Right? And by the way, Christianity doesn't make up original sin. Read the book, right? I mean, Adam did something wrong, and nothing was quite the same afterwards. It was the first... Well, the difference is that we believe that Adam sinned, but that does not intrinsically make you a sinner. Remember, Rav Kook already said that, because what makes you a sinner, according to Rav Kook? Existence. Meaning what Adam did was expressive of human existence, which is not a skeptical, world-rejecting, mean, nasty God view, but rather is what? The only way you have to grow. Let's not forget what we've learned. He says, Mitzad zeh chet muchrach. Remember, he said from this perspective, sin's an absolute necessity. Why? In order to express your full selfhood. Right? If you don't struggle and fail, how do you ever grow? At the same time, you know what? Not everybody grows through their failures. Right, there is a process of alienation and loss of selfhood, which can come through failure as well. And he's pointing out that that can be intergenerational. Right, it's od ma'at Well, I'll tell you, Od Ma'at is also Yom Kippur, but it's also, of course, the anniversary of the Yom Kippur War. And if you guys are familiar with Israeli history, there's something which was called the Concepcia. Anybody know what the Concepcia was? It was a very simple notion. The Arabs would never, right, after 1967, they would never. So much so that as they massed their armies on the borders, and as like the intelligence services started saying, it's going to happen, the Concepcia, but they would never. And you know what happened? It was this close. Oh, they did, right? And so this is part of what we mean by the intergenerational. You just have a way of knowing the world. And it is a monumental task to question the way in which I know the world. Not what I know, the way in which I know. Because what I know is the information in front of me. How did I get to the standards of measure and the conceptual framework that puts that information in front of me? That's a much harder question to ask, much less answer, right? And so we get stuck. Right now, according to Jewish tradition, we are stuck in Esav's concept. We've been there since Rome. So much so that we don't even know what it means. Should the state of Israel be the next best Western power of the world? I mean, you know, there's all these voices out there in the Christian right and in the religious Jewish right saying that we are the bastion of the West right now. We are upholding the Western values of, where are they rooted? This is our goal? Now, mind you, what's the problem? What's the alternative? What would it look like to uphold the model of Yaakov instead of Esav? Answer is, we don't really know because we've never done it. It's an important question. I can tell you what it doesn't look like, but that's for discussion for another time. So here we are, we sin with our fathers. And he says, the sin of the first man who was estranged from his selfhood. It's a very powerful word, by the way. She'nit naker me'atzmiuto. Yeah, he was alienated. Right? Nikul is alienation. Nit naker. He was alienated from his selfhood. Shepana l'dato shel nachash. He turned toward the consciousness of the snake. What does that mean? V'avad et atzmon. And then he lost himself. Let's go through it really briefly. Okay. God says to Adam, don't eat the fruit. Right? All of a sudden, scene shifts. We see Eve. Right? Chava. Chava's about to eat, or she's hanging out or whatever, and along comes who? Snake, who seems to have known the entire conversation that happens between Adam and Chava, and then whatever convinces the snake, convinces Chava what? No, God doesn't want you to eat from the tree, because once you eat from the tree, your eyes will be open. And you'll know the difference between good and evil. And you'll be just like God. Right? You'll be just like God. It's the ultimate illusion. Now, it's true enough, because you'll notice at the end of the story, after Adam eats it, what does God say? Well, next thing they're going to do is reach out their hand and take from the tree of life. Now that their eyes are open and they know the difference between good and evil, it's like, oh, I've heard that before. Like, where? That was the snake. Which is his own question of, like, who is the snake and where exactly does he come from and how does he know everything? He's the only one, by the way, go back and read the story, he's the only one who's honest from the beginning to the end. The key here, though, is the snake offers Adam an illusion of selfhood. He offers him an illusion of selfhood. You could take God off the throne and you'll be the standard of what's right and wrong. Because, you know, as the Rambam says, truth and non-truth are very different than right and wrong. Truth and non-truth, at least in the pre-postmodern era, right, were an absolute objective standard, right? It's not a question of opinion that the earth is, you know, round and not flat, despite the fact that apparently increasing numbers of people believe it's flat. They're wrong, right? That's not a matter of a subjective opinion. It's an objective reality. Is that good or bad? That we could talk about, you understand? right? And so there is a whole tradition that says, well, what was Adam thinking? Why did he do it in the first place? I'll tell you why he did it, because there's a much greater opportunity to grow and thrive in a world of subjectivity. I mean, think of it. Yes, no, eat the fruit, don't eat the fruit. That's it, that's all I have. There's only one problem, is that you can't grow and thrive if you lose your standard of measure, right? So what does Adam do? It's kind of like he sees the hall of mirrors right there. The snake says, look at all that potential. See all those worlds? You could make worlds just like God. Adam says, no problem. I'm going to get in there. I just am going to step in. He eats the fruit. He steps into that hall of mirrors. He says, just don't lose the door. That's it. Now he can't even tell where he's standing, much less what's right or wrong. Oh, you'll create worlds, yes, in your imagination. That's not going to help you know what's real and what's not real, which means your desire to know right from wrong, as we know from human experience, is going to be messy. Right? And he goes on and he says, Avad et atzmo, he lost himself, lo yada leishiv tshuva brua el shelat ayeka. But what's the indication of this level, this first level of alienation or estrangement of self? He can't answer the question, where are you, right? So what happens? Adam eats from the tree. Chava eats first. She gives to Adam. They eat. They suddenly realize they're naked. We're not going to go into the details. You know the story. And then God comes looking for them. It's a very strange scene. And he calls out what question? Ayeka, which means what? Where are you? Which, you know, even in a simple reading is clearly not a geographic question. Right, Ayeka, what's God, even Rashi brings the Midrash, what's God saying? Adam, where are you at? Right? Where are you at right now? And he's giving him an opportunity to own his behavior. And by the by, it's a little bit off the side, but it's important to me actually to say this to everyone that I can. In my humble opinion, this is where the sin happens. Not when he eats the fruit. Because like Rob Cook said, disobedience is built into creation. But you can't have your cake and eat it too. Meaning what? If he's going to assert his own will against God, what should he do when God says, where are you? Yeah, own his behavior. Listen, God, I ate the fruit. We got to talk. Instead, what does he do? And then blames his wife, because he can't hide from God. Meaning the real sin of Adam is blaming Chava. And I'm not just saying that because it sounds nice. I'm saying it because he asserts his will and then refuses to own the behavior. You can't have both. Right? And so in that moment, he's unable, says Rav Cook, to answer clearly, where are you? He has to shift the blame. By the way, what would a clear answer to the question, Ayeka, be, where are you? That's an honest one. But he says, he actually wants a, you know, tshuva brura. What is the biblical clear answer to Ayeka? Oh, hineni. Here I am. You know, just imagine my teenage daughter calls me. She says, Abba, I need you to come pick me up right now. And I say, okay, where are you? I'm right here. Yeah. Right? There's something very profound about that. It may not be so helpful in the practical sense. But meaning the, who, of course, says Hineni? Avraham. Yes, several times. If we had a semester together, we roll this over into the Akedah, where he says it three times. Who does he say it to? Shem Elohim, Yitzchak, and Shem Havaya. That's a very important progression that we can talk about some other time. What Rav Cook is saying is that if Adam wants to know where he is, he has to know where he's at. And he's so lost his sense of selfhood that he can't own his behavior. Hineni is not a geographic location. Hineni is Avraham's, right, saying, here I am, I know who I am, I know what I'm about to do, I'm ready. It's the opposite of where Adam is at. And that's the first stage. Rav Cook says, and once you lose that standard, it's hard to regain. Remember, he says, Chatanu im Avotenu, we sinned with our forefathers, right? Mipnei shelo yada nafsho, he didn't know himself, couldn't own his behavior. Mipnei sha'aniyut amitit nevda mimeno, he lost his true selfhood, because his true selfhood, according to Rav Kook, comes through freedom. Adam took his freedom. God said, don't eat the fruit. He ate the fruit. And then what did he do? He avoided owning his freedom, and he completely lost it. Right? Because that's what the Nachash promised him. You'll be just like God. Nobody's going to hold you accountable for your behavior. You can do whatever you want. There's no such thing. You can do whatever you want, but own the behavior, own the consequence. You can't do it. There is no free lunch. The snake tried to pick, is the ultimate free lunch, by the way. The story of Gan Eden is the ultimate attempt at free lunch. God told them not to do it. And then when God said, what did you do? Oh, it wasn't me. Right? So it didn't work, needless to be said. Right? So, and then he says, interestingly enough, Bechet, sorry, he lost his true I-ness. Bechet ha-ishtachava le-elzar. In the sin of bowing to a false god. Wait, Adam bowed to a false god? Who did Adam bow to? No, to himself. And I'll tell you something. I think that the Nachash, do we have time for this? Not really, but I'll say it anyway. The Nachash, I think, is the physical manifestation of the desire which emerges when Adam and Chava are split from one another. Which is why the sages read the whole thing as some sort of sordid sex play, if you're familiar with the way that they read it. It's not a misreading, God forbid, nor is it just a moralist reading on an existential tale. It's an expression of what happens when other exists and you don't know how to enter into right relationship. And of course, the backbone of every relationship is owning your own behavior, right? Anybody ever find it went well when they blame their spouse for something? Yeah, exactly. I've never gotten a positive response to that one. Okay. So I'm sorry, moving quite quickly through here because I want you to see at least the full picture of what he's painting because it's quite dramatic. So the sin of Israel, chet chata Yisrael, or Israel sinned actually, but whatever. I translate it, the sin of Israel, right? Ze achrei Elohei nechal, right? Pursuing false gods, et aniut atzmiut azav, and they abandoned their own independent einus zanach Yisrael tov. Israel abandoned goodness, or tov. Really quickly, what's the ultimate national sin of Israel? We already mentioned it. Ten. Now, which one? Oh, that hurt. The golden calf. Golden calf, all right? Golden calf. Let me just get that one out of the way. Right? I mean, the sages say it was like a groom who runs away with the bridesmaid from under the chuppah. I mean, it's not an accidental choice of language. It's like, yeah, it's as bad as it gets. You're like, my best friend at the wedding? You know, it's like, that's exactly what they say. You know, they don't pull punches. But here I just like want to touch, and we talked about it enough, and I don't want to go back through it, so hopefully you can plug in our discussion from then. But this statement, zanach tov, the word tov is a key word in Torah. Because, of course, I think we spoke about it. This you know, the first chapter of Bereishit, if you were a sort of elementary school teacher who'd ask God to write an essay about creation, and you got back the essay, it's good, I thought the light was good, and the fish were good, you would give that essay back to God and say what? Tell me something that means something. Good, 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 good. Right? But it's a rather powerful repetition of a word, which, by the way, doesn't mean the opposite of bad, because there is no evil at that point. There is no ra. It's not a moralist language of this sort of dualism, good is known because it's not bad. It's an aesthetic good. It's that which is reflective of the will of its maker, which at that point is everything. And that's what Rav Kook's saying. What's the alienation that happens here? With the alienation, the fact that there's only one thing. Once you bow to part of creation, once you sort of isolate off something as an absolute other, that's the ultimate act of idolatry. Especially to Rav Kook. In Od Milvado, he says, well, the Torah says it, but he's quite wedded to the idea, there is nothing other than God. And the whole art of living is an art of living a separate but not discrete existence. Did I draw you guys my terrible tree? I say terrible because I'm not such a great artist, but we'll do green because that's vaguely tree-like. Now that I've given it away, now you'll even know what I'm drawing. A lot of times I've had some funny answers. I say, well, what's this? And you're like, I don't know. Right? But what's this? Oh, gosh, I'm so glad. Right? Here's a tree. So we can all agree that this branch is not this branch, correct? Tell me where they separate. It's kind of hard to identify. They're separate, but they're not discrete. They are clearly different things, but they're not other than one each other in the absolute. Right? And there is an art of living, and certainly a perspective that Rav Kook brings to existence, which is about the necessity for separateness, which allows for covenant, the ultimate purpose of creation. But covenant also depends upon the sense that we are really not other than one another. Otherwise, how could we ever possibly enter into a covenant? Covenant's not a contract, right? That's a part of what a covenant is. But the contractual part is the easy part. The other part is this sense of joining, which allows me to be something that I couldn't be without you. Right? The ultimate covenant in daily Jewish life is what? Marriage. Right? Where we understand how Israel can't be what we want to be without God when we enter into that covenant, because God is God after all, right? But what does God get out of it? You ever wonder that? What does God need? Well, God must need something if a contract has two sides. We always say a covenant has two sides, right? And God seems, by the way, if you read the prophets, God seems to be quite attached, one might even say wedded to Israel, right? I'll tell you the one thing God gets, so absolute relationship. You can't have a relationship without other. But if I'm absolutely other, then we have no relationship at all. Correct? What I need is be separate but not discrete. Right? And so this zanach tov is we abandon the sense that everything is, when we say it's all good, nothing drives me more nuts than people say, right? It's all good. Yes, but not in the moral sense, in the existential sense. Everything is reflective of God's will, but don't tell me that means it's good in the moral sense. Because that means when babies die and you know people suffer, like you know, and this is a very, I think, childish theology that's out there. Well, that's good. It has to be good because it's the will of God. You're correct, just you don't understand what the word good means. You understand the difference? It's a very important difference. Kol da'avid rachmana latava avid. You guys know that phrase? Everything which God does is for the good, right? It's a story about Rabbi Akiva, who's got a rooster, a torch, and a donkey. Right, guys, he's hiding and he goes to the city to seek refuge, and they're like, not here, Rabbi. Go sleep in the fields. And, right, and then he goes to sleep in the field, and the wind comes and blows out his torch, and a fox comes and eats his rooster, and I think it'll be a lion or whatever comes and eats his donkey. And he's sitting there in the dark saying, everything that happens, everything is for the good. I mean, kol da'avid rachmana l'tav avid. Everything which God does is for the good. And then, of course, like the Romans come and they sack the city while he's sleeping in the field. And since he had no light, they didn't see him, and the rooster didn't crow, and the donkey didn't make any noise, and all the people of the city died. But apparently that's for the good, right? People miss that part of the story. They're looking at Rabbi Akiva, and he's like, everything which God does is all good. They're like, really? I mean, not for all the dead people in the city it wasn't. Right? He's not saying it's morally good. He's pointing out it's God's will. And that if you receive the world as God's will, it means you're able to maintain relationship with God even when you encounter things as morally repugnant. Why? Because now you have a challenge of understanding God, which you may not be able to answer. By the way, whole civilizations have risen and fallen without being able to figure out the theodicy thing. The question is it a break in the relationship or not? When someone you love does something which you don't like, do you walk away? Do you hold it as a question? Or do you work together to fix it? Those are three different options. Right? But the latter two are premised on the belief that there's only one person there. And if it's the person I love that did the wrong thing, it's still the person I love doing the wrong thing. You understand? The idolatrous solution is zanach tov. No, there's God who only does good, and then there's the other one. You understand what he's saying? Is that when Israel bowed to the calf, zanach tov, they became alienated from the ultimate unity of creation. So we got a lot more here. I'll try to just touch it. Sin of the land, which in Rav Kook's, he has elsewhere in Orot Teshuva, a beautiful piece that God commands the trees in the first chapter of creation to Eitz Pri Oseh Pri, fruit trees that bring forth fruit. But what does the earth actually produce? Eitz Oseh Pri, trees that bring forth fruit, meaning the tree was supposed to taste like the fruit, says the Midrash. But the tree doesn't taste like the fruit. Ultimately, the earth, somehow, it's the sin of the land, denied her selfhood, contracted her strength, and went after objectives and results. This is the alienation of product from process. Right? The tree tasting like the fruit is the idea that the whole process of producing the goal would have the sweetness of the goal itself. Just imagine how good life would be. Yeah. This is the next level. Meaning he went Chata Adam, Chata Yisrael. Now we're going Chata Aretz. We're getting even more fundamental, yeah. This is the alienation of product from process. That when the earth, instead of creating trees that tasted like their fruit, created a tree which produces fruit, it becomes all about the product and not a valuing of the process. Right? And here, he says, she didn't give all her power hidden within her in order that the taste of the tree should be as the taste of the fruit. She lifted up her eye outside of herself to contemplate matters of fate and career. It's very interesting that he uses this word karira, which I always thought was modern Hebrew, but apparently he had it too. This is obviously a longer discussion, but I think we're all familiar with it, that most of the failures that we have in life happen because we give up along the way. The process orientation necessitates a belief that I'm going somewhere. And imagine how much success, much more successful I would be if I could taste the fruits of my labor as I labored. When I think of that phrase, tasting the fruits of my labor. Right? This is the difference, by the way, between slavery and service. Right? Am Yisrael comes out of Egypt and we go from slavery to what? Servitude. Right? So it's from servitude to service. And the difference between the two is that when if you've ever had a job which you only had because you needed to earn money, and then you had a job you did because you believed in the mission, you know the difference. One is servitude. You're just after the product. The process you could do without. If someone came to you and said, I'll pay you the same amount of money and you don't have to go to work today, most of us would say, what? Woohoo! But if you have a job that you believe in the mission, which helps you be who you want to be in addition to paying the bills, it wouldn't be so simple. Because if you just got the money at the end of the day, but what about the person you want to become through the process? That you wouldn't have. Right? And that's one of the great challenges. And Rav Kook is identifying in the mythic language that the Midrash uses, that was the sin of the earth. There's a much deeper conversation there, but I want you to see the wholeness here, and I'm gonna sort of wrap it up because we only have a few minutes. So with your permission, I just want to touch on the last piece here, which is he says, then there's the accusation of the moon, or the complaint of the moon, actually probably would be a better translation of it, right? He's referring to the Katerga HaYireach, right? Or the moon complained. The Midrash in the Gemara in Chulin tells a story that the moon, again, in the lines of the first chapter of Bereishit, says that God created two great lights and set them in the skies, and then the next line it says the lesser light and the greater light. So the sages picked up, like, well, which one is it? Is it two great lights, or is it a lesser light or greater light? So in their, again, mythic language, they say that the moon came to God and said, Ein shtei melachim mishtamshim b'keter echad. You can't have two kings with the same crown, says the moon. And God said, you know what, you're right. Go shrink yourself. Right? And so Rav Kook says, the accusation of the moon, who lost her inner orbit, her joy in her portion, by dreaming of the external glory of kings. What happens to the moon? What's the moon quintessentially? Where does the moon get its light from? From the sun. Right? She wants to be other than what she is. Right? Which never leads to anything good. Meaning, she has a real complaint to God, by the way. If you read the Midrash closely there, it's not so clear that God isn't, that we're actually making atonement for God every Rosh Chodesh for God's failure. You should read the Midrash. It's quite interesting. right? Nevertheless, what Rav Kook is pointing out is that I'll tell you one thing, there's another form of alienation, and that's an alienation from independent selfhood. Even if I'm only reflected light and the sun is really the source of light, you're not going to get anywhere by judging your level of success and selfhood by something other than what you are. Right? Meaning, like I said, in the Midrash, the moon might have a legitimate claim against God for creating that situation to begin with. Fine. But you know what? By definition, as soon as I start complaining, but I'm not that, I just shrunk myself. And I'll never be what I am because I've chosen external measure to try to define my selfhood. And that is an endless pursuit, as I'm sure we've all known. By the way, and much of our culture is built on it. The whole cult of stardom is built on this notion. You'll never be, social media literally raising the levels of depression and suicide because people are surrounded by that which they will never be, but which has become the measure for what they want to be. Yeah. Facebook's passé, we're all getting old here. Right? He goes on in very powerful fashion to talk about how the loss of I, and the whole world, he says, continues to sink into the loss of I, of the individual, the whole, and then learned educators come, and here he's, I think, attacking his peers in the secular Zionist worlds, and they look at the externalities, distracting the mind from the I, I love it, adding straw to fire, quenching the thirsty with vinegar. Whew! But now listen to this. And since there is no I, there is no him. Meaning, as soon as you lose your selfhood, don't think that this is just an independent problem. You lose the ability for a right relationship. And all the more so there is no you. People might be familiar with this phenomenon if you've read Martin Buber's works and his relational theology. Right? If there is no I, there is no you. I can't enter into relationship with you. This is a breakdown of the framework for relationship at all. But listen to this. He says, there's the breath of our nostrils, Mashiach Hashem, the Lord's anointed. This is his might and glory of his greatness. He's not from outside of us. He's the breath of our nostrils. And he goes on to say, we'll seek the Lord and David our king, getting rid of all sort of strange gods, aliens, etc. And listen to this last line. I'll do it in Hebrew because it's much more powerful. It says, you'll know that I am the Lord your God. Mitzrayim brings you out from the land of Egypt, liot lachem Elohim, in order to be your God, ani Hashem. How would you translate that those last two words in light of all the work we just did? Ani Hashem, where is God? In one's essential selfhood. And thus the peace comes full circle, is that the loss of essential selfhood is a loss of God in the world. And if one wants to seek God, the way to do it is to find oneself, right? Because the whole arc of sin that he just laid out there, which could happen on the national scale or on the existential scale, finds its expression in the individual, right? And so therefore, just in the last literally minute and a half here, I just want to take us back to this structure here and why, in my eyes, Rav Kook's approach to tshuva is so important. Because there is an essential selfhood, as he says, that life in its natural essence finds its expression through the cycle of sin and tshuva. Not out of obedience to an external standard, but because tshuva kadma l'olam, tshuva precedes the world. It's the foundation on which the world in which we live was built. Because your life is meant to express a specific facet of God in the world. This is what he says, that the search for the essential I is the search for God. You cannot separate the two. Now, there's a whole host of challenges. I'm sure many of them come up as soon as I say it. But nevertheless, I think it's a fair presentation of that piece. And we're going to stop there because it's time to...
This was a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. To learn more about sponsoring a podcast, please contact Jamie at pardes.org.